Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to a bonus episode brought to you by the lovely folks over at Solal. This episode is sponsored by Solal. If you've been a True Crime South Africa listener for a while, or you follow the show on social media, you'll know that the last 5 years have been a wild ride for me. It's been amazing, and I am incredibly grateful for all the opportunities. But going from being a sales manager in a 9-to-5 to being a podcaster and the author of 3 true crime books in such a short space of time has often left me feeling exhausted. In 2022, when I received my first book contract for Samurai Sword, I had about 3 months to write the book. I was also still running the podcast and doing freelance writing for a few clients at the time. It was insane. And I will admit that I came very close to pretty much totally burning out at the time. So when Solal approached me to talk about a sponsorship on the podcast, it was a no-brainer for me because it was actually one of their products that helped me through that period. I came across Solal's Burnout Adrenal Support product during that time, and it made an incredible difference. Solal's Burnout Adrenal Support has a mix of herbal ingredients that will help with tired adrenal glands, extreme fatigue, chronic fatigue syndrome, stubborn weight gain, mild depression, and stress from certain situations or stressful jobs, which I think is a pretty good description of mine. I used the product for about 6 months in 2022, and it really helped me to get through that time. I haven't had a need for it again since then, thankfully, but I've recommended it to a bunch of my friends, and they've all benefited from using it. One thing I really like about Solal, which I noticed on their burnout product, was that they specifically say you should take a 2-week break between courses. This really made me feel like the company isn't just out to push product, but they're actually concerned about the well-being of their customers. Solal has a wide range of products to help promote physical and mental well-being, so there'll undoubtedly be one that suits your needs. You can view their product range on their website at solal.co.za or check out their products at any one of their multiple stockists. A huge thank you to Solal for sponsoring this episode. The wonderful team over at Solal are True Crime South African listeners too, and as such, they figured that there would be nothing more that True Crime South Africa listeners would enjoy than a good old bonus episode. So you can thank Solal for this bonus content in your feed today. Last year, for the first time, I covered the 6 finalists in the International DNA Hits of the Year event. Over the last few years, South Africa has seen many changes in its DNA legislation landscape, and we're now moving toward a time where DNA will play a major role in identifying previously unknown perpetrators and solving the thousands of cold cases that exist in the SAPS's records. If you've listened to True Crime South Africa for a while, you'll have heard me mention the name Vanessa Lynch and the organisation DNA for Africa. I consider Vanessa a friend of the show, and it is her incredible work through the organisation she heads up that has led to much of the legislation finally being implemented in South Africa that we need to move forward with our forensic DNA work in this country. Vanessa started her work in DNA activism when her father was murdered, and the DNA evidence in his case was badly bungled. Last year, I covered the International DNA Hits of the Year because there was a South African case among them. This year, our cases didn't make it to the top 6 finalists, but I still wanted to cover these because Vanessa announced the winner at the HIDS conference this year in May. And also, because I think it's really important for us to see the power of DNA in action and how valuable it can be in solving crime and in humanitarian work. These cases are often absolutely fascinating too, and hearing about how DNA is being used to solve crimes may well spark ideas for our own local cases. So let's get into the top six finalists of the DNA Hits of the Year for 2024, a bonus episode brought to you by Solal.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
The first case in the DNA Hits of the Year finalists for 2024 comes out of the USA. From 1991 through to 2004, three violent sexual assaults occurred in Tuscaloosa County, Alabama, and El Paso County, Colorado. After the 2004 case was entered into CODIS, the DNA profile matched to the 1991 case, and investigators then knew that they were dealing with a serial sex offender. But despite all their efforts at that time, there was no way for them to identify who the DNA profile belonged to. The offender clearly had not yet come to the attention of law enforcement, nor had he been convicted of a crime, so his DNA was not yet in CODIS, and investigators had no choice but to wait until he either offended again and someone could identify him, or technology advanced to some extent that they would have some other tools available to them. At the time of the crimes, an identikit was developed from the victim's memory, but even that had not helped investigators. It would take 17 years for another opportunity to present itself to solve these three cases. In October 2021, the DNA sample from the 1991 case was submitted to Parabond Labs for possible genetic genealogy research. I've spoken about genetic genealogy quite a lot on the podcast in other episodes. It really is a groundbreaking tool and has resulted in many cold cases being solved in the US. Essentially, what the tool involves is taking an unknown DNA profile and using public DNA databases like 23andMe to match the profile through relatives, and thereby identify possible individuals who could be the perpetrators of the crimes. Once individuals are identified, this gives investigators a far smaller number of suspects to look at, and they can take DNA samples from those individuals and compare them directly. Perhaps the most famous arrest and conviction made to date by using genetic genealogy was the serial rapist and murderer known as the Golden Gate Killer, who had committed rapes and murders over the course of several decades and was never arrested until genetic genealogy was tried and a man called Joseph DeAngelo was arrested. The man was already in his 70s by then and had stopped committing crimes because he knew he would be overpowered by his victims. He was convicted and sentenced to several life sentences for his crimes. Although this tool is clearly very useful, it has also been questioned for how it may interfere with individuals' rights to privacy. 23andMe does allow users to opt out of forensic searches when they enter their data, but some have still questioned whether this is fair, because not every person in that user's genetic family tree will have consented. Either way, it remains a powerful tool for now. Sadly, in South Africa, this is not really an option yet, as we don't have a very large culture of using such platforms, and even if we did, we don't have legislation yet that would allow such searches. Thankfully for the victims of the case in question here, though, investigators were able to use Parabond Labs, who has become a service provider of such searches, to look for their unknown offender's genetic DNA familial matches. The search did yield a result, and after further investigations to ensure that the suspect was indeed the right match, authorities announced that they had managed to solve the three sexual assaults. Unfortunately, the suspect had already passed away, so there were no arrests or legal justice. But for the victims of the offender, they at least had the knowledge that the man who had raped them had been identified and was no longer a threat to them. The suspect identified was called Elliot Higgins, and he lived in Jemez Springs, New Mexico. Higgins had been a music teacher, and his family had run a music camp in the area too. Higgins had specialized in the French horn, and at one time he was the conductor of the Albuquerque Philharmonic, as well as a manager of the Santa Barbara Symphony in California, and the Fort Wayne, Indiana Philharmonic in Indiana. Higgins had previously been arrested and convicted for sexual assault, but that was in the 1970s, long before DNA was being taken from offenders. What it did show was that Higgins had been a lifelong sexual predator, and looking into his background would make investigators wonder just how many crimes he may have been responsible for. As part of his role in the music industry, Higgins had helped found a music competition for college students who played the French horn. As a result, he often traveled to different universities across the United States, and the periods during which he was in Alabama matched up with the time that the sexual assaults there had happened. The identikits drawn up after the attacks in question also matched Higgins. Higgins had been a predator hiding in plain sight, and after these revelations came to light, his friends and family members said they were completely shocked, but also believed that the evidence was correct and overwhelming. Higgins' daughter said that she'd had no idea her father was a sexual predator, and she now has to try and match up the loving father she knew with this new understanding of what he was doing to these victims over many decades. A fellow music teacher who'd been a friend of Higgins for decades and who had accompanied him on several of the college French horn competition trips said that he felt he'd been duped by a master manipulator and liar. After determining that Higgins was the offender in these cases, investigators have sent his DNA profile and other information to the law enforcement officers in the other areas where Higgins visited colleges over the years for the competition. Those law enforcement jurisdictions have been asked to check for unsolved violent sexual assaults in their areas during the times that Higgins was there. It's highly unlikely that Higgins only committed these three sexual assaults and the one in the 1970s, so it's very probable that additional cases will be attributed to him in the near future. The second case in the top six finalists of the DNA Hits of the Year 2024 also comes from the United States, this time from Louisiana. While the previous hits involved genetic genealogy and the CODIS database, this case would be solved using a technology called Rapid DNA and a database called NDIS. Rapid DNA is a technology that is currently available to law enforcement, which reduces DNA processing time down to just 90 minutes. In 2019, several law enforcement officers in the US started to implement these machines by placing them alongside fingerprinting machines in booking centers. The main booking identification system remains the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, or AFIS, but a rapid DNA instrument for DNA analysis has been added. Both systems are synced with the Criminal Justice Information System, or the CGIS hub. The DNA sample is then immediately searched against the DNA Index of Special Concern, or DISC, and then searched at SDIS and NDIS, which are broader databases, at the next scheduled auto-search. These databases contain DNA samples from crime scenes where the cases remain unsolved, or DNA profiles which are unknown, but have been linked to several different crimes, such as the prior case I discussed. Now, I know this all sounds amazing, and it really is, but it also has its limitations, as the DNA analysis is not always done for every single person booked into the system. Once the arrested person is fingerprinted, the AFIS system uses certain criteria to determine whether the arrestee should also have their DNA taken. I wasn't able to find out what those criteria are and how they're determined, but it does leave space for some offenders to slip through the cracks. But it is, of course, a huge leap forward for many law enforcement agencies. With that explained, let's get back to the crime this technology helped solve in this instance. On the 9th of June 2020, an 80-year-old woman was driving her vehicle home in Atlanta, Georgia, when she was forced out of her car at a traffic light by an armed woman. The carjacker held the victim at gunpoint before fleeing in her vehicle. The victim's vehicle was found abandoned a few days later, and detectives found a cool drink can in the car, which the victim confirmed was not hers. Police were able to retrieve a DNA sample from the can, which was entered into the system, but yielded no results at that time. The East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office was one of the first law enforcement offices in the United States to get permission from the FBI to install the rapid DNA devices in their booking center. The system went live on the 1st of August 2022, and on the 14th day of August 2022, it had its first success story. Baton Rouge officers had arrested a woman, Fabulous Cordray, for being in possession of a stolen vehicle. Cordray was transported to the East Baton Rouge Sheriff's Office for processing. There, her fingerprints were taken, and the AFIS system flagged her for a DNA sample to be taken as well. When her DNA was entered into the system, it alerted officers to a match to a sample taken from a cool drink can in the carjacked car, in the car that had been carjacked in Atlanta 2 years before. Fabulous Cordray was arrested on that charge as well, and in an identification parade, her victim identified her as the person who had carjacked and held her at gunpoint. Now, I have absolutely no doubts that Cordray would never have dreamed that the cool drink can she abandoned in her victim's vehicle would be DNA tested. She may even have thought that that level of investigation would not be employed in a crime which hadn't led to violence, although being held at gunpoint is traumatic enough, of course. And she may have been right under ordinary circumstances. Certainly under normal circumstances, it's unlikely that her DNA would have been tied back to a cool drink can. But with the rapid DNA system, that could be done in less than 2 hours, ensuring that while she was still in custody, they could match her up to other outstanding crime scenes. It's truly incredible, in my opinion, and such an exciting addition to booking centres. From a South African perspective, I can tell you that a few years ago I did chat with a gentleman who was trying to get the SAPS to allocate budget to have these rapid DNA machines installed at our own booking centres. At the time, there was a question about whether there was resources, money available for this, and the gentleman in question was going to continue trying to get this technology available to our SAPS officers. I don't, unfortunately, have an update of where we are in South Africa at this time with this technology, but there's no doubt that it would be hugely beneficial to us. The third case in the six finalists for the DNA Hits of the Year 2024 comes from Guatemala and the United States. And it's a case that is highly relevant in South Africa because we too have a significant challenge when migrant workers come into our country and pass away here, sometimes without paperwork to identify them. This is something DNA for Africa is working with other African countries to solve as well, by developing a database to which family members who have lost contact with their loved ones can submit their DNA and unidentified bodies will have their DNA compared through that database to help identify them and return their remains to their family members. The case in question here also uses similar methods to help reunite the remains of a young Guatemalan man with his family. The National Institutes of Forensic Sciences of Guatemala, or INACIF, and the Center for Human Identification from the University of North Texas have been developing a humanitarian project since 2017, which aims to help identify missing migrants. The names used for the mother and son in this case are pseudonyms. Pedro was 33 years old when in April 2021 he decided that he was going to travel from Guatemala to America to find work and hopefully improve his and his family's lives. Sadly, individuals who decide to make this trip are often taken advantage of by traffickers, colloquially referred to as coyotes. The migrants pay these coyotes to help them get safely across the migrant route, and it's really the only way to get through the route safely, because often if migrants don't pay the coyotes, they've been known to be killed along the migrant routes if they are traveling unaccompanied. It's essentially a traveling protection racket. Coyotes do know the route well and may add some level of value to migrants, but certainly not the level of value for which they are charging. And of course, there is a major element of coercion in there to use them. With that said, Pedro had procured the services of a coyote to assist him on his journey, and he kissed his mother, Juana, goodbye in Guatemala, promising to keep her updated on WhatsApp as much as he could. And he kept his word, sending her messages along the way, regaling her with stories of his travels, and telling her not to worry, and that he would keep her updated about his location. A few days into his journey, Pedro sent his mother a message saying that he was going to be crossing the desert, and he wouldn't have phone, battery, or signal to text there. He estimated that the journey through the desert would take several days, but promised that as soon as he was out and could get signal and charge his phone, he would let her know he was okay. His final message to her was, "I love you." Juana waited for her son's messages over the next few days in vain. She heard nothing from him, and as the days turned into weeks and then a full month, Juana was not willing to wait anymore, and she started to try reach out to the coyotes who Pedro had hired. When she received no response from the men, the mother felt entirely helpless. And over the next few months, she continued to dig, often putting herself in danger with individuals who don't want to be identified to try and figure out where her son was. Finally, several months after Pedro had gone missing, Juana received a message from one of the coyotes who'd been with him on the migrant route. He callously gave Juana the news she had most feared. "Your son is dead in the desert." He fainted from the heat, and the group left him behind. Juana was devastated. Her worst nightmare had come true. Her son's dream of finding a better life in America had ended in a horrific death in the desert. And now she had no idea how she would ever find her child's remains to lay him to rest. Pedro's family spent months contacting various organizations within Guatemala for assistance to no avail. Pedro's dad got to the point where he simply could not continue on with the search. It was depleting the little resources they had, and he just didn't have the strength to go on. But Juana could not get the image of her son laying out in the desert, alone and discarded, out of her mind. So she pushed on, and one day she got the lead she needed. A member of staff at the Guatemalan Ministry of Foreign Affairs mentioned, almost offhandedly, that there was a project going on with officials in the US to help identify deceased migrants through DNA. It was a flicker of hope, and Juana decided to take it. Several days later, her DNA was taken by the National Institutes of Forensic Sciences in Guatemala, and her profile was submitted to the shared database. Her sample would become one of the first to be compared in this database through the UNT Humanitarian Genetic Data Bank. Thankfully, despite Juana's ongoing nightmares about her son laying out in the desert, Pedro's body had been discovered by US officials and taken back to a mortuary. It was not uncommon for officials to find deceased individuals on the migrant route, and even when the remains do have identity documents on them, they're often fake. Up until that point, the main way for these individuals to be identified was to know which country they'd come from and submit fingerprints, if the body was not too badly decomposed, to the Home Affairs Division of their country of origin and hope they could find a match. Now, with the DNA database, a sample of Pedro's DNA was taken and entered. Of course, a match can only be found if the family members of the individual have reported them as missing and done what Juana did and had her DNA collected. Thankfully, on this occasion, everything worked exactly as the originators of the database had envisioned. And a few weeks later, Juana was advised that her son's remains had been positively identified and were safely in the possession of US officials. It was certainly not the homecoming she or Pedro had hoped for. But when his remains were repatriated, his family was at least able to lay him to rest, and his mother no longer had to endure the nightmare of wondering where her son was. The fourth case in these six finalists for the DNA Hits of the Year 2024 comes from Iraq and is quite bizarre and undoubtedly very disturbing. The case was entered with the headline, Incestuous Acts, A Child with Multiple Alleged Fathers. And to preempt the discussion of this case, I'd like to mention that while incest is illegal in most, but not all, countries in the world, the interpretation of what incest is and when it is illegal differs. Iraq, the country where this case takes place, does have legal provisions in place to address various forms of sexual offences, including incestuous relationships. The Iraqi legal system is also influenced by Islamic law, and the interpretations and enforcement of these laws can sometimes be influenced by cultural and regional factors in various parts of that country. The case in question came to the attention of Iraqi officials when on the 5th of April 2023, a laboratory was requested by a court to do a paternity test for a female child and an alleged father, who is referred to as AF. The alleged father was accused of sexually assaulting his sister, which had resulted in the birth of the female child. The laboratory compared saliva-derived DNA samples from the child to saliva-derived samples from AF and found that there was a 99% match. However, the test compares 24 loci on the DNA strand, and only 23 of the loci actually matched. Ordinarily, this would be sufficient to ascertain paternity. Most paternity tests work on a 97% and above certainty rate. In this case, the report sent back to the court was that AF could not be excluded as being the father of the child, and there was a 99% certainty that he was. In the interim, the mother of the child had disappeared and been reported as a missing person. A trial was held, and the court found AF guilty of incest. He was sent to prison, and the child in question was put up for adoption, as her mother could not be located at that time. But that was not where the story ended. Not by a long shot. In September 2023, the lab had drawn a sample of DNA from a local teenager who was suspected of theft. When the young man's DNA was placed into the criminal database, a surprising match was made. He too was a 99% match in paternity to the child who had previously been tested by the lab and determined to have AF as its father. AF, who was now in prison for incest, was now relabeled AF1, and the teenager was labeled AF2. The police now had themselves in a quandary. Had they convicted the wrong man? How was it possible that two men could be such close matches for paternity to the same child? Parts of the puzzle would be solved when it was revealed that the teenager was actually a family member of the siblings in question who were believed to have produced the child in incest. The teenager was AF1 and the mother's nephew, by family structure at least. So to summarise, we have a child born to a mother whose brother and nephew both match as possible paternal donors. The brother is in prison for committing incest, and the child has been adopted out. But now, the mother is located, and her saliva is now taken to DNA test, as scientists and police are now wholly confused about whether this woman is even the mother of the child, and the sister and the aunt of the other two. And it would be while the woman was having her DNA sample taken that the truth would come spilling out. The woman, who was 27 years old at the time her baby was born, admitted that she had been the victim of rapes perpetrated by her three brothers from the age of 12. The woman said that her elder sister, who was deceased, had also been a victim, and both had been regularly raped, tortured, and kept as veritable prisoners in their homes from a young age. She said that her brothers had forced her sister to get married to a man they knew was also abusive, so that they could continue raping her. Her sister had had one son from this marriage, and when she had died, the boy, her nephew, had come to live with their family, because his father had allegedly not wanted anything to do with him. The woman said that although everyone had claimed her sister had taken her own life, she believed that her sister had been murdered. After her sister had died, she'd become like a mother to her nephew, and what she told investigators next was incredibly disturbing. She said that when her nephew turned 13, she had started to, in her words, have sex with him. Of course, this was absolutely rape. He was a minor. She was in a position of power over him, and he could not consent to this. I acknowledge, of course, that she too was a victim, but this does not take away from her nephew's trauma. He was a victim of rape from his aunt, and according to the woman, continued to be until she had fallen pregnant with his child. When her family had discovered she was pregnant, they were concerned that one of her brothers was the father, so they tried to force her to have an abortion, and she'd refused. When the child was born, and it emerged that there were suspicions of incest, and her brother had been accused, she hadn't said anything to counter this, because she believed he deserved to be in prison for his rapes against her and her sister. But she was certain that the child's father was actually her nephew. There's no indication in the report about this case as to whether additional action would be taken against the woman or her brothers. Thankfully, the baby remained with its adopted family, and the family name was kept out of the media to ensure the child's anonymity. The story is truly wild and completely horrific for every victim of this long line of generational abuse. I am really grateful to the power of DNA, though, for helping to put an end to the cycle and hopefully allow some healing for the young boy and a healthier future for the baby. The fifth case in these six finalists for the DNA Hits of the Year comes out of Indonesia, and it involves using DNA to discover the identity of a suicide bomber. On the morning of the 7th of December 2022, a man drove a scooter onto the premises of the police station at the Astana Anyar district in West Java, Indonesia. The police officers stationed there were conducting morning drills on the field when the man got off his scooter, drew a knife, and ran into the group of police officers before detonating a bomb he had strapped to his body. The attacker, as well as a police officer, were killed, and 11 other people were badly injured. In situations like this, even though the perpetrator is deceased, it's still vital to identify them. Firstly, so that their own next of kin can be informed of their death, but also so that investigators can understand why the crime was committed and possibly trace others who may have been involved or may be planning similar attacks. The crime scene was closed off, and investigators carefully collected fragments of the bomb as well as the remains of the attacker. These remains were sampled for DNA, which was then compared initially to Indonesia's convicted offender database. This quickly matched the profile back to a man who had been convicted of being involved in terrorist activities in 2017 and remained in prison until his release in 2021, just a year before the attack. The man's name was not released, I presume to protect his two minor children. This DNA identification became vital, though, because as a result of knowing this individual's identity, Indonesian police were able to track down another 26 accomplices who'd been planning other attacks and had bomb-making materials in their possession. In this case, this one DNA identification likely saved countless lives in the future. And the last of these six finalists in the DNA Hits of the Year for 2024 comes from the Philippines, but involves an American soldier and dates back to the Second World War. The soldier in question, U.S. Army Air Force's Private First Class Glenn A. Harris, was born to his parents in 1916 in California. The Harris family were ranchers, and Glenn was the second born of six children, five boys and one girl. Glenn was not the only one of his siblings who reported for duty when the United States officially entered World War II on the 7th of December 1941. His brother, Forrest, also enlisted, but while he returned home in 1945, Glenn did not. By the time the United States had joined the war in December 1941, there were already thousands of U.S. soldiers based in the Philippines. The chain of islands that makes up the Philippines was a strategic location for both the Allied forces and the Imperial Japanese troops. General MacArthur, who headed up the U.S. military response at that time, had even chosen to create a headquarters on a Filipino island, then called Corregidor, and now called Fort Mills. As a result, 10,000 U.S. soldiers and 65,000 Filipino soldiers were on the island when, in March 1942, MacArthur made the decision to suddenly abandon the headquarters, leaving all 75,000 soldiers behind, with Japanese forces quickly invading and capturing them. What followed was an act that would be called the Bataan Death March, named after the peninsula of the Philippines on which it occurred. The 75,000 starving and sick soldiers were taken as prisoners of war and made to walk 65 miles through the jungle to a railway station at San Fernando. The trains would take them to Camp O'Donnell, which had been a Filipino military base which had been claimed by the Japanese and turned into a prisoner of war camp. Thousands of soldiers would not make it to the railway station, dying along the way. And those who did were not much better off. Over the next few months, another 27,500 prisoners of war died at Camp O'Donnell. The Japanese eventually realized that holding on to so many prisoners was untenable and started to release the Filipino soldiers on the condition that they would not rejoin the war effort against Japan. The US soldiers were not released, and instead they were transported to a different camp called Cabanatuan on the Luzon Peninsula, where other US soldiers were already being held. Glenn Harris was among the soldiers taken to Cabanatuan. At the camp, prisoners took it upon themselves to ensure the orderly and recorded burial of their fellow soldiers. During the 2.5 years that Cabanatuan was functioning, 2,764 burials were recorded. I have no doubt that the soldiers hoped that by recording the names and burial sites of the fallen, they may one day have their remains reunited with their loved ones. The methods undertaken were rudimentary, of course, having very few resources to hand other than a piece of paper and a pen. But essentially what they tried to do was bury each day's dead, because multiple people were dying every day, in a single grave, and then record the names of those individuals either by burying a piece of paper with them or keeping a record in an old notebook. Many times they would do both, as they were concerned their notebook would be taken by their captors and they'd lose all the information. In January 1945, the camp was finally liberated, and the few remaining prisoners of war were released. When the survivors let US officials know that they'd been recording the grave sites of the deceased soldiers, the American Graves Registry Service came in to officially map out the area. Over the next few years, the bodies were exhumed and moved to a US facility in Manila, and the arduous process of officially identifying almost 3,000 bodies began. Although the prisoners' records were very helpful in narrowing down who was buried where, bodies still needed to be officially identified to ensure they were handing over the correct remains to the correct family. Some of the soldiers had died wearing their military identification tags, which were helpful and created for that exact purpose. But others had had theirs removed, or they'd been lost in the many transfers that had been made between camps. Between 1947 and 1950, the unidentified bodies were moved again to the AGRS mausoleum at Nichols Field near Manila. And in 1950, the official Cabanatuan project was started to attempt to match up the historical records with the anthropological records. In 1951, though, the project was abandoned, and the approximately 1,000 bodies that were still not identified were buried in the Manila American Cemetery. The families of those lost who believed their loved ones had been in the camp simply had to accept that they would never be able to lay their sons, husbands, and brothers to rest. Fast forward more than 60 years, though, and in 2014, some of the descendants of the victims of Cabanatuan started to push for the remains to be exhumed and modern-day DNA capabilities be used to help identify more of the victims. While excellent methods existed even at that time to extract DNA profiles from skeletal remains, the officials tasked with identifying the remains struggled to get reportable profiles and only managed to get good profiles from about 39% of the bodies. It was also discovered that one of the centres at which the remains had been stored over the years had treated the remains with a chemical preservative mixture, which in some cases had disrupted the DNA collection process. Not to be deterred, The organizations continued to apply ever-advancing DNA technology over the years to the remains, and although this helped identify several victims who were then returned to their loved ones, many, including Glenn Harris, remained unidentified. Restricted funding also meant that the bodies had to be exhumed in groups, and often several months or years would lapse between new groups of bodies being exhumed from Manila and testing starting. Finally, in 2018, the remains which had been buried at grave marker 225 at Cabanatuan were due for exhumation. 18 prisoners had been buried in this grave, and although a rough note had been found in the grave, written on the back of a milk label with Glenn Harris's name on it, and the cause of death being malaria, those working on the project had also found that many of the remains had been intermingled after their initial exhumation. So there was no way to guarantee Glenn's remains were among them without a positive DNA match. This new project had even found that the initial handling of the remains had been so bad that partial remains from some of the bodies already identified and handed over to families were found left behind in other graves. And the project coordinators had to undertake the terrible task of informing families who thought they'd moved past the point of laying their loved ones to rest that they actually had not been given the entire remains. Glenn Harris became one of the last victims to be identified, and his identification was also the one with the highest level of certainty of all the remains. When the project had started, Glenn's last surviving sibling, his youngest brother Wayne, had provided a DNA sample, and this close familial relationship was very useful. This had become a major hurdle for the project, as the further down the familial line the DNA comparisons went, the more difficult it was to say with absolute certainty that the remains belonged to a specific individual. But with Wayne's help, Glenn was eventually identified. Sadly, by the time the official determination was delivered to the family in 2023, Wayne had already passed away, along with all of his siblings and his parents. But Glenn Harris's remains were handed over to a large group of his descendants, nieces, nephews, and their children, and they arranged for him to be laid to rest one final time in California. Private First Class Glenn A. Harris was finally home. At the HIDS conference in May this year, our very own Vanessa Lynch announced the winner of this year's DNA Hits of the Year, and it was the case of Glenn Harris. I know that I am lucky enough to have many professionals in this field as listeners of my podcast. If you work in any field that utilizes DNA for forensic or identification purposes, and you have a case that you think could be the DNA Hits of the Year for 2025, I strongly encourage you to head over to their website, dnahitsoftheyear.com, and submit your case. If you need help, please reach out to me and I can help connect you with the right people to get your submission in. With every case I cover in which there's either an unsolved murder or remains that need to be identified, I'm reminded how the not knowing is almost the worst part. Advances in DNA are a vital tool for us to utilize to get justice and some elements of the ever elusive closure for victims of violent crime in South Africa. So I'm happy to have been able to share these success stories with you to help highlight this important area of crime investigation. If you find this interesting, I also strongly recommend heading over to the DNA for Africa website and supporting and following their incredible work. Once again, thank you so much to Solal, who is now a new sponsor of True Crime South Africa, for helping me to bring this bonus episode to you. Please consider supporting the sponsors of True Crime South Africa, which helps to support the podcast too. Thank you. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Lived Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.